Hello and welcome back, everybody, to the Ortho Talk podcast, episode number 30 this week. That's right, we've made it to 30 episodes, and we are bringing back a very special returning guest, Dr. Scott Porter. You may remember Dr. Porter from back in June, episode number 6, where we brought Dr. Porter on and talked a lot about diversity. This week, we are switching gears to another passion of his, entrepreneurship. We talk about his MBA and the recent project slash company that he has just started, Just Cause Scrubs. This is a scrub company that you can go online, buy a pair of scrubs or a jacket or a lab coat, and 50% of the profit goes straight to a charity of your choice. That's right. It's really that simple. And we really break down his motivation for this company, how he started it, what drove him to start it, and all that good stuff. So give it a listen. The website for his company is justcausescrubs.com. It is a very worthwhile cause, and I really do encourage all of our listeners and tell your friends, if you are in the market for scrubs, which most of us are at some point, give it a try and make a worthwhile contribution to a charity of your choice, justcausescrubs.com. And for this week's episode, without further ado, Dr. Scott Porter. Hey, can we time out? All right, all good dudes, stop what you're doing. This is Time Out. This is the Ortho Talk podcast. Today we are doing a real conversation with an illustrious guest. Surgeons today are Asith Khalid and Jay Chen. Antibiotics, ANSEF, of course, what do we even ask? Fire risk, high due to lit conversations and explosive topics. Any questions or concerns? Nope. All right, we can go. Incision. Welcome back, everybody, to the Ortho Talk podcast. This is episode number 30. We've made it 30 episodes, and we have a guest coming back from, I believe, episode 6 or 7 or something, some way early. Dr. Scott Porter. Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah. Congratulations, so guys. Wow.
Yeah, I'm surprised too.
I can't believe it. It's still going, so we're still getting listeners, so we haven't killed it yet.
That's fantastic. It's good to have family ties, right? Is it mom, dad, brother, sister kind of thing? Or
extended family. Yeah. We pay people extended to listen. Family.
There you go.
Financial family. That's what it is.
Yep.
So thank you, Dr. Porter, for coming on back. Dr. Porter we're not going to talk anything about diversity this episode. I want to focus solely on entrepreneurship. And we did plenty of that before. So solely on entrepreneurship and this project that you're starting, that Jay and I both checked out the website, read the article, Just for Cause Scrubs. So tell us about the project you started, your motivation behind it, what it is, and we can start there.
Yeah. Thanks for having me back again, and hopefully the road noise won't be too bad for the listeners. But the not too long version is years ago when I had gone through medical school and all of those things, I remember thinking that it was wonderful. Patients. I loved it all. And I was sitting in a boardroom after I had finished fellowship, and I remember an administrator referring to patients as customers. And I remember thinking that, number one, I have no idea what this administrator is saying when they're talking about accounts receivables and this, that, and the other. And number two, at what point along the journey between 1993 when I started medical school and 2005 when I finished training, did patients become customers? And so something happened, and I wanted to kind of figure out a little bit about it. So with the American Orthopedic Association, a fantastic group, they had these classes that you could take on business principles. And they were kind of higher level classes and higher thought kind of stuff, nothing too in the weeds. And so I took a couple, and the light turned on, and I figured, man, I need to learn about business. So I applied to Kellogg in Chicago in Evanston, and was lucky enough to get in and ended up getting an MBA. So with that, it sparked this desire to create something that's bigger than just me, create something that will be more lasting than just treating one patient or one family at a time, and create something that I can actually draw some strength from as a cancer surgeon, you put it out there a lot, and a lot of blood, sweat, tears, emotion are left in that operating room or in that office every single day, and I needed something to help me to replenish. And so I started a charity that was called Sarcoma Warriors years ago, and that charity morphed into this business, which is Just Cause Scrubs. And quickly, all it is an online scrub shop. It's the same uniform shop, kind of a thing that you would get if you went to whatever uniform shop in your hometown, if you went online to whatever scrub store that you choose online. Same stuff, same scrubs, largely the same price. The only difference is we split our profits 50-50 with charity. So, and you don't learn that in business school, but you do learn that cutting out cancer. And philanthropy and altruism is amazingly important. I'm amazingly blessed by my day job in terms of paying mortgage and sending my kids to school. And I've got friends that are equally blessed. And so we've come together and we have created this company that I'm hoping is going to disrupt the scrub space completely. And that is a company that is putting philanthropy and altruism before profits.
Now, when you just on the company itself and the logistics of it, which charities do the profits get to go to? Is that something that the customer can pick, or is that something you have set beforehand?
Both. And so the this kind of a model, this socially conscious model, is one that in many states, it has to be registered with the state. So we're registered, and when doing so, you also have to not only register but declare your relationships with the charities that you are supporting. So we can't just pick any random charity. We actually have to go through a small process to onboard a charity. And so we've got over a dozen charities with whom we have existing relationships. Shriners Hospital, National Pediatric Cancer Foundation, National Breast Cancer Foundation, JDRF, Project Hope, which is a fantastic autism charity. It goes on and on. So we've been very blessed with relationships with charity because they see the opportunity, they see the potential. Same scrubs, same price. We split 50-50 the net profit.
That's amazing. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, you talked about getting your MBA, and most physicians, at least the ones that I've talked to, get an MBA so they could better understand business, so they can make more money, right? But you kind of flipped that. You flipped that on its head, and you got your MBA so that you can help be more philanthropic, basically, right? So it's kind of flipped on its head. That's pretty cool.
Well, you got to realize that my parents, you know, I'm first generation college, first generation med school, first generation, all that. And even as a cancer surgeon, man, I'm blessed. To make $1 million in healthcare, $1 million a year in healthcare is great for some, but for me, I'm fine where I am, and it's so much more fun to do this in supporting others. So much more fun.
We read your. Oh, I'm muted. No wonder.
Oh, no, you're not muted. You are not muted.
No, you got it. Oh, yeah.
No, I'm like, okay. Well, we read your story on the on your website, and it was one of the most insightful things that I'd read lately. It was really awesome to read. I recommend all the listeners, you know, read that.
Yeah, we'll definitely link to it and blast that out. So
I was, you talked about how surgeons just have a certain number of big cases in them. And what it takes to replenish your ability to keep performing those big cases, which I thought was really insightful. And how did you figure out that philanthropy was kind of your way of replenishing that? And go into that a little bit.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you read it, and I'm glad it resonated a bit with you. And so it was a blog that my marketing folks kept telling me that I should write. And so I wrote that blog, and it took a while. It took a lot out of me to write that, because it was about a dear friend of mine who passed away with sarcoma. And so the point is just like that blog submits, if you do big cases, and big cases are defined by the person doing them. So I'm not by any means submitting that tumor cases are any bigger or smaller than anyone else's cases. You know your big cases. But when you do big cases, they oftentimes take a toll. They take an emotional toll. They take an intraoperative toll. They take a postoperative toll. If that patient passes away, as a dear patient of mine just did Sunday night, that I have been caring for now 8 years, through two major surgeries, the resection reconstruction, then the amputation, then the multiple nodules resected. I mean, just, you know, it takes a toll. And so I don't know if it was that I found that philanthropy did something as much as I like to think that I've been philanthropic the whole time. And what I've realized is that it has been a very useful rock on which to support the 9-to-5, what I call the W-2 job. So I didn't set out thinking that this was going to be related as it has become. But now I've just come to realize, to understand how interrelated it actually is.
So when, as far as these, you know, I think you're totally right about the toll that a lot of these cases take. And, you know, we're both just starting out, so we don't really know the feeling, but honestly, even in residency, you would get those days and weeks where, you know, you would just not be feeling it anymore. And, you know, at least when you're training, you don't really have the choice of not going to work and taking time off and finding something else. You just kind of push through it, right? But I guess the good thing about being out of training is that you can kind of explore the other side of life. And I think that's a common theme that's becoming more and more prevalent in medicine, and not just surgery, is people finding things outside of work and outside of medicine that allow them to keep doing medicine. Because the people who live, eat, and breathe medicine, you know, it's, you can tell it wears on you and your attitude towards life and your family and other relationships. So I think we've learned from the mistakes of the people before us, and we're starting to realize that we need something outside of this to keep going.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But here is the problem that I've seen just in being a program director and being all of those kinds of things and enjoying my residence and watching this, is your generation has an amazing ability to maintain the compass pointing northward on work-life balance. You guys get it much more than my generation, and infinitely more than generations before me. Here is the thing, though, that I hope, and I try to get my residents to see, and I hope that everyone will see this to some degree. It is very hard to have work-life balance yet seek the 1990s, early 2000s pay.
Right.
Those things don't work. Mm-hmm. And that's when people get into trouble. And so I really have come to a very comfortable spot with my work balance, because starting a company is not life. I mean, my wife will tell you it's still work, but I am very comfortable with not looking at the material possessions and whatnot of others, and focusing on the fact that these things bring me joy. So I joked earlier about not having a lake house or a beach house or a blah, 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 blah. But my house or my lake house or beach house, or this out of the other is this business. Like it's that is where I get my, that is where I get my joy. And so wherever someone gets their joy, lean into it, get it, love it. But just realize that oftentimes that joy is not going to generate anything more on that W-2. And if you're comfortable with that, then I think you've won a good bit of the game.
Nice. Yeah, it's pretty insightful. Interesting. You mentioned kind of the divide you've noticed between my generation and kind of older generations in terms of the attitude towards work-life balance. I've always found interesting how people from the older generation will kind of say we're getting soft and, you know, we're not really learning to work hard anymore in our training with the 80-hour work week and all those things. And it's pretty refreshing to hear someone, you know, who's got more experience than we do, yourself, talking about how it's actually, you know, a good thing and necessary. So I think that's just really cool to hear.
Yeah, I think that nearly every statement has some kind of a kernel of truth, right? So a lot of the points that everyone makes on both sides of that argument are valid, decent points. But I think that at its core, the working beyond your abilities, the 80-year-old who's lost a step, the person who's afraid of retirement, I don't think those are going to be issues nearly to the degree they are now when your generation reaches that age. I really believe that this is not a debate on the 80-hour work week and any of that kind of stuff, but it is, I think, a recognition that that you guys have a healthier outlook than we do. And many of us have to find these outlooks or find these alternatives, whereas you guys seek them out. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
I think, just kind of adding on to that, and something you touched on in the article was that it's not only about personal well-being and personal mental health, but something you say, I think you mentioned kind of at the end of your article, is that a surgeon or a physician that's, you know, not burnt out, that takes care of themselves and is mentally stable, mentally ready for, you know, all the emotions that come with surgery or medicine, they take care of patients better too, right? So, you know, they're better able to cope. Yeah, I think it's fair to say. So, it is about the individual physician, but I think also patients get a better relationship with it. They get better care. I think it just benefits everyone overall on a grander scale than, you know, people just plodding through their W-2 job, getting burnt out and exhausted and, you know, learning to hate life.
Yeah. So that's absolutely right.
We talked about kind of your motivations for philanthropy and getting an MBA. So why scrubs? Why did you choose kind of to do a kind of a scrub company type thing?
So it's interesting. One is because we wear them all the time, and so there's a little bit of in-house knowledge on scrubs, the way they feel, and those kinds of things. Two is if you're going to start a business, not only do you want to start a business in something that you know a little bit about, but it also helps to start a business in something that will complement your Rolodex. And so as a physician, we all know lots of other physicians. And so that works. And the third thing is much more of a business concept than anything else. And that is that scrubs are a commodity market. There are very few points of differentiation between many of the scrubs. Now, there obviously are some scrubs that are fantastic scrubs and infinitely better than most others. But the point, though, is that in a marketplace that there are innumerable entrants with very few points of differentiation, if you can add a point of differentiation, your chances of success are higher. So our point of differentiation is this customer-directed giving program that we've come up with. And with that, we're hoping that we can get some customers who are interested in the giving component and not so much the scrub component. And the last thing is, in the scrub market, the majority of the scrubs that are out there, with the exception of sales, are governed by prices that are set by the manufacturers. So we can't be undercut, so to speak. Now, it might be a dollar here, a dollar there, one way or the other. People have sophisticated pricing schemes. We're giving half of our money away to charity. So their pricing schemes, their formulas, their computers are going to be better than ours. So there might be a dollar here or a dollar there. But at the mean, the prices are set by the manufacturers. And so we can compete on emotion, which is what our strong suit is. And that's what we have going for us. So those four things.
Nice. So the scrub market is kind of interesting, right? Because it's like you said, you got these, there's all sorts of scrubs. And we got in trouble for making fun of figs like a couple months ago.
What did you say you got in trouble?
Do you sell figs on your website?
No one can sell figs but figs.
Yeah. We were talking to a medical student about basically away rotations, right? And we mentioned that you don't want to be the medical student that shows up when everyone else has plaster covered hospital scrubs and your nice embroidered figs and stand out in front of everyone. So we got a little bit of a pushback for that, because apparently there's a few orthopedic surgeons that, you know, wear scrubs or wear figs pretty proudly. So
it's an interesting debate. It's a timeless debate. It'll never die down. So
and Figs got in trouble too recently, because one of their advertising campaigns was, you know, a disaster as far as, I think, women and adults.
They got in big trouble with that. So we don't sell them.
he's on our side.
No ties. I'm agnostic. We do not sell figs.
And this is kind of a sidetrack, but, you know, talking about, I don't want to get too much stuck on designer scrub brands, but Blue Sky used to be a thing and it kind of disappeared. Did they go out of business? Do you know?
I don't know.
Yeah, they used to be like, I guess, what figs are now, but I don't know. That's kind of a sidetrack. I was just curious if you...
No, you were about to make some profound point about scrubs, though, so I'm waiting with bated breath.
Yeah. No, I just had the story. I just had the story of us getting in trouble, and that was it.
Yeah.
I don't have too much on scrubs, no. kind of switching gears a little bit, I'm curious, I wanted to ask you about the charity you started. Going back to the, was it Sarcoma Warriors?
Yeah, that was it.
How did that come about? You kind of talked about the motivation behind it, but how does one exactly start a charity?
Oh, wow. That one is an interesting story, and I'll give you the Cliff Note version of that as well. So we, there was a patient that I had that had an osteosarcoma of the lower lumbar spine. And the gentleman passed away, and he would have passed away. It's a horrible place to get a sarcoma. The problem that I had, though, is that I think that he passed away with less dignity than anyone who is living should have when they pass away. And my story for his passing was that the absence of dignity was specifically because of his poverty. And I thought that was absolutely ridiculous. And so when he would miss appointments, because no one in the family had a car and he couldn't get to the appointment. Medicare van or whatever, he had no way to get to the appointment. And I remember sitting in the office thinking once, I mean, what the hell? This is ridiculous. This is America. I will buy him a cab ticket. It doesn't matter, a cab fare. He just needs to get here. And so fast forward, he passes away. And and we're in the office, and I'm saying this is absolutely ridiculous. And so at the exact same time, someone was making a 5K, and they asked me to support them in this 5K that was for cancer. So I got a whole bunch of my residents together, and I said, if you guys run this 5K, I'll buy some T-shirts for us. And so I bought some T-shirts for us, and it's ridiculous, but I'm sitting in there, and I'm with my medical assistant, and I'm saying, what should we call ourselves? And I really don't like the word survivor, because it makes it sound passive, like you just simply were there and you lived. My patients are fighters, right? They're not survivors. They're fighters. So my assistant says, why don't we call ourselves sarcoma warriors? And I said, that is fantastic. So we made these shirts. We race in this race, take pictures. We laugh. Don't think anything about it. A couple of weeks later, I get a check in the mail for $1,000 anonymously made out to sarcoma warriors. So I'm sitting here with a $1,000 check to an entity that doesn't exist. And so I call a buddy of mine, and he says, the only way that you can cash that check is if you actually have an organization named Sarcoma Warriors. So my wife and I spend $5,000 to cash a $1,000 check and start Sarcoma Warriors.
So Sarcoma Warriors, I guess basically the goal is to help the treatment of sarcoma patients that are impoverished and help them get to appointments and get their treatment that, you know, that you feel like they should, or any human really deserves, right?
No, the goal was, I've put it in on ice now because I can't do all these things at the same time. So I put that one on ice. But the goal of that was to raise money to pay the bills, the ongoing daily living bills for patients that had or that were actively being treated for their sarcoma. So we paid rent, we paid mortgage, we paid light bills, heating bills, car notes, travel documents. We raised about $250,000 over the time that we did it. And we bought 15 years of mortgages and rents for people. It was amazing. It was amazing. It was awesome. But I got burned out by just simply asking buddies for money. We had an event every year. I just needed more. And that's what led to Just Cause Scrubs.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is what pushed you to go from one charity to another? But that makes a lot of sense, because now you can give something in return for the charity side of it.
Yeah, I selfishly get the fun of trying to create a business from scratch, right? Get that. We've got a great several people that are helping us with this, and it's so much fun to try to start something from scratch. So I am selfishly taking a little bit of that, and hopefully will at some point be giving a whole lot back to society.
So I think there are probably a lot of people out there who want to do something like that, but they don't know how to get started. And I think a solution to that is probably to get an MBA and learn all the business side. But then people probably, in their mind, there's probably a mental hurdle to getting an MBA. And now you've done it as a physician. So can you speak to what is the workload it takes to get an MBA? Do you have to put your clinical duties on hold? You know, kind of people who are thinking about getting an MBA, what does it take to get one?
So there are an increasing number of physicians who get MBAs every year. So it is something that is feasible. I would highly recommend exploring it. I would highly recommend doing it. I would support anyone in doing it. And I would also support their returning to medicine and hospital administration and the like, because I really think that that is when we are going to change the curve, truly bend the curve of healthcare. But that's a whole different podcast. But the fact that so many physicians are doing it, to me, suggests that it is feasible to be done. No, I did mine. I started 10 years ago into the program, and I didn't have a reduction in my workload, but my research time, in air quotes, research time was completely given to the pursuit of the MBA. So I didn't have any efforts at publications. I didn't have any effort at anything except completing the MBA. I did Kellogg. Again, I was very fortunate, very blessed. It's their executive MBA track, and that is every other weekend for 2 years, flying to Chicago and having classes Friday, Saturday, Sunday morning, and then flying back. And so that's what I did for 2 years. I gave up working out, so I put on some LBs. But I had a wife, I had kids, and I didn't want them to suffer. So I would get up in the morning, and in the morning, not even the dog is awake, like no one cares. And so 4 in the morning, I would start with studying. 4:30 in the morning, I would start with my studies, and then I would go into the hospital 6:30, 7 or whenever. And on weekends, I would sleep in until about 6, and then I would stay in my home office from about 6 till about 10 or 11, and that's what I did for 2 years.
Wow. And for those people that are young in their careers, medical students, for instance, is there an ideal time to get that MBA? Should you get it during med school? Should you try to get right after your training, or maybe after you've had a few years of experience as a full-time physician? Is there a better time?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm the best to ask about that. I have a strong bias, and I think that when you're in med school, you should be learning about the beauty of the art that you are about to practice. I believe that. I think that you should be purely interested in how do we take care of patients. When you're a resident, in my very humble opinion, you should be thoroughly invested in how do I become a better surgeon? How do I cut people better? How do I make my hand-eye coordination better? All of those things. I think that when you are beginning to hit the upslope of your practice, that is the time to find a way to fit it all in. You're beginning to understand the business side of your practice. You're beginning to hear the terms that we use on a regular basis in our business meetings. You're beginning to develop some curiosity about these things. And the MBA at that point, I think, will be of greater yield, and even more important, even greater yield, won't detract from the important other pursuits like learning how to take care of people.
Hey, reporter, let me ask you this. Do you think you could have started this business without an MBA?
No.
Fair.
But I was business stupid. I was a business idiot. So there are a lot of people out there that learn business principles from their parents or from a mentor or those kinds of things. And there are a lot of physicians that have outside business pursuits that do not have an MBA. So I do not think the MBA is necessary unless you are like me and a business idiot.
I think that's a lot of us.
That's probably most of us doctors. Interesting. And so it sounds like your MBA was pretty involved in terms of flying there every other weekend. And there are a lot of MBAs. I did a little bit of searching probably a few months ago to see what was out there. There are a lot that are mainly online, and just a few weekends a year or 2 or 3 weeks a year, they fly you into a location to do in-person things. Do you have an opinion on when you're selecting an MBA program? Is that as good as ones where you're flying in every other weekend, or what do you think?
It depends on your goal. The other option is if you're on staff at a university that has a business school, to get the MBA there. And so those are the three options. And I think it depends upon your goal. For me, comically, even though I graduated from a public high school, I became a little bit of a school snob. And so I did not know what I wanted to do with the MBA. And I wanted to have an MBA program on my resume that would speak to something with its reputation. Right. And so I wanted more than just the three letters that say a lot, and we should all be very proud when we have those letters. I also wanted that aspect of it. And so I like the Kellogg name. I like the Kellogg reputation. I like the Kellogg network. All of that to me was very important, because at the time I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know where I was going to live. And I wanted a CV, a resume that would allow me as much flexibility as possible. That is what you get from a Kellogg. I think what I learned at the school, I could have learned at any MBA program, and had done so for a lot cheaper than Kellogg. But what I wouldn't have gotten is the things that I just spoke to.
Yep, that's a good reason. I mean, names open doors sometimes. So.
Sometimes, and that's the most important word in your statement. Sometimes.
Yep. Sometimes. Yep.
So transitioning a little bit, and you kind of mentioned this a couple minutes ago, your family and the role they played. One of the figures in the blog post you wrote that was really interesting was your grandmother. Can you talk about how your grandmother influenced Just Cause Scrubs and your whole career going forward?
Yeah. So and it's my grandmother et al. Right. It's not just my grandmother. So I keep a picture on my phone of the cabin that my dad grew up in, and it was either their slave cabin, whatever, their neighbor, quote unquote, or where they went to school. And my dad and his two remaining brothers couldn't figure it out, which was hilarious. But I keep it on my phone because that is where I think for me grounding occurred. You know, my grandmother couldn't read or write, and so those stories I said in that blog were real. My grandmother had no idea what it meant to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. No idea. She thought that when I graduated from high school, I was doctoring, and that's what she would call it. My grandma, Granny, I'm in college. Like, I got a long time. Oh, okay, baby. You doctoring yet? Yeah, no, Granny, I'm just finishing college, and I'm in med school. The beauty of that simplicity is something that I am amazingly proud of. Just like people are proud when their parents are accomplished lawyers or accomplished doctors, and they give their kids a lot of the benefits that brings, right?
Right.
Well, on the other side, the benefits of growing up the way that I grew up are also immeasurable, and are as equally beautiful to me. Now, did I vacation in our lake house? Did I go to it? No, I didn't know. But to know that your dad was a sharecropper in southern Alabama, and his son has degrees from Morehouse College, Yale University, Northwestern University, University of Chicago. Man, that is some amazing stuff, man. That is beautiful stuff. Mm-hmm.
No, I agree. And yeah, it's like you said, there's certain parts of our upbringing that you really take pride in. It kind of helps. And you mentioned one before was graduating public school. And I think that's a very underrated thing. I think all three of us, Jay, you went to a public school too, right? Public high school.
I did. You know, it was, I can't act like it was not a well-off high school though. It was a top 50 public school. So, you know, but it was a public school.
But still, I think there's still a big gap.
We're still going to claim you, brother. We're still going to claim
good. I'll take it.
There's still a big gap though, between even a well-off public school and a private school, because it's still a totally different environment. I don't know. I'm very glad I went to public school, you know, all through my education, because it gives you a different sense on life and a different sense on relationships with people.
What I enjoyed the most about my upbringing in terms of school is just the diversity of friends that I had. You know, I know we're not going to talk about diversity, but I just mean in terms of, you know, I had friends that had money, friends that did not have money, friends from all backgrounds, and me, you know, playing basketball on the basketball team helped a lot as well, because everyone can play basketball. You know, it's a nice sport where everyone can play. So that was my favorite part of my upbringing.
Fantastic, man. And that's the thing. And so to me, that's what makes a well-rounded physician. That's what makes it. If you can have those well-rounded memories, that's what it's all about, man.
Yeah. And, you know, again, let's not get into diversity too much, but even the negative parts of public school, like there's a lot of physicians that will never know the feeling of having to wake up and go to school when there's a talk of a big gang fight in the morning before in the auditorium, and being scared and having to dodge that. Right. Like, that's a realistic thing for a lot of people, but a lot of people don't get that unless you go to certain public schools growing up. And there's all sorts of stuff.
Where did you go to school?
This was in Missouri City in Texas, suburbs of Houston.
Right on, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was for middle school. I can't say that I stayed there for my whole time, but at least for part of middle school, we had a little bit of a rough middle school there. That stuff it carries on in the future. So that's a good segue actually to one of the last questions I had for you, was when you talk about types of physicians or types of doctors and how that's really ingrained in you, you know, growing up and from the influences you have growing up. And it comes out when you're stressed and when you're basically running on fumes or running on instincts, is that's what you have to fall back on. So I think that all plays into it, right? The stuff you have, you know, going to school and the memories you have there, that all comes out as a physician, because, you know, that's what you know, that's what you're taught, and that's your instinct.
Totally agree.
A lot of those instincts they're developed, you know, before you're in school, just as you're growing up, and they're molded, like you said in your article, they're molded by the influences, the people that influence you in your life. So,
and yeah, I think you could probably, I think part of it is probably trainable, like in residency, but honestly, once you hit that age and once you hit that level of education, most of what you have is what you already have, right? And I guess if you're training at that point, at least personally for me, and I may be wrong, but I think a lot of that is teaching yourself how to act differently than what you really are. And if you're not a nice person and you have to learn how to be nice in residency, you're really just learning how to act nice to people, right? And I think we've seen that in co-residents that have gotten in trouble and had to go to remediation and stuff. And, you know, eventually they all fall back to where they came from and their true selves show. So I don't know, that's my two cents.
You know, it's amazing that we will say that the plasticity of the human mind, of the brain, will not allow an individual to become fluent in a new language if they have not started that by the age of fill in the blank. And it depends upon who you read. But there's this belief that there has to be enough plasticity, youthful plasticity, to learn something as important as a foreign language. Yet, when you're talking about hand-eye coordination, when you're talking about behavior, when you're talking about the manner in which we interact with one another, we somehow think that those things can be learned to the point of being fluent for the life of the learner. And I've never understood why we don't hold things to the same degree. I agree with you. I think that at some point, absent a major event that causes you to move off of your natural, and by natural, I mean what is learned, upbringing, those kinds of things, off of your natural position outside of that major event, I think it's very hard to do. Those major events do occur, but outside of those major events, I think it's very hard for the human mind. I think it's very hard for someone who's never been altruistic to become altruistic. Now, it's not hard for them to write that they are altruistic on their admission, on their admissions personal statement. That's easy. But it is very hard for them to be altruistic if they've never been altruistic before the age of fill in the blank. And I think that that blank is before the age of 26 to 30 when most people become residents. I think. So I agree with you largely.
Yeah.
So I agree with you guys as well. You know, Dr. Porter, that kind of transitions to something that's been going on in my life currently, which is interviewing medical students for residency, which is, you know, Monday was the first time I got to do that. And you were a program director, and you're still interviewing medical students as well, I assume. What do you, you know, it's just like we've been talking about, a lot of their behavior is kind of already dictated or kind of made at that point when they apply to residency. What do you look for when you're selecting students, and how do you discern, how do you try to discern those characteristics in applicants?
So that's a very interesting question, and that's another podcast in and of itself as well. But the short version for me is that I do not look for superstars. I don't think that you can select superstars, so I don't look for superstars. I try to avoid problems. So that's a massive difference in terms of thought process going in. I do not look for superstars. I try to avoid problems. So that's number one. Number two, I think that if you look at the admissions package, and not packet, but package, the entirety of the individual that is sitting before you, what I really enjoy doing is separating what mom and dad allowed them to achieve versus what they have achieved on their own. What does that mean? I really don't care what your MCAT score or your USMLE score is, because if I dive down a little more deeply into those two things, I will likely find that you have the ability to have tutors. You have the ability to take the SAT, MCAT, and whatever else multiple times. You have the ability to have a class that taught you how to take these exams. You have the ability, fill in the blank, fill in the blank, fill in the blank. Who gave you that ability? Well, mom and dad gave you that ability. So that disinterests me. You travel all over the world. Oh, okay. Unpeel that. And a lot of the times, not all the time, a lot of the times, these are trips that are funded by mom and dad. Okay. So to me, I look for things that the applicant has done. Walk on to their college sports team. Now you've piqued my interest. You didn't have to walk on. You didn't have to get up at 4 a.m. to just ride the bench. I mean, this is somebody who I'm now very interested in. Farmers, any kind of farmer of anything. First generation, anything. You have made yourself better than the previous generation by any number of metrics. These are the things that I think define diamonds in the rough that aren't going to be problems when they come to your program. We focus entirely too much on superstars and disregard the red flags that are before us because we look at all of their superstarness. And I try hard to not be enamored by those things.
Very similar answer to, yeah, very, very similar answer to what the program director at my institution also said when we had him on the podcast. You know, he said to avoid people with, he doesn't look for superstars. Rather, he tries to avoid people with certain pathologies. So very, very, very similar answer. That was, that's Mark Forman.
Right on.
Yeah. So I like that. Maybe I'll keep that in mind next time I interview people.
All right, Dr. Porter, as we kind of wind down here, just for the future, Just Cause Scrubs, what do you hope to achieve going forward? Like, say, 5 years down the line, you want to break the whole scrub market here? Is that what we're going for? And make some good donations to charity and kind of rise up other people? What's the ultimate mission statement for Just Cause Scrubs?
That's it. I want to unite as many people that wear scrubs with their favorite charity through those scrubs as I possibly can.
Okay. I think that sums it up perfectly. So perfect. All right. Just Cause Scrubs is the company. You can go to the website, justcausescrubs.com. More than scrubs, actually, is what I'm finding out. Like jackets, socks, lab coats, everything. Choose your favorite charity. Split the profits 50-50. For a good cause. If you're going to buy scrubs anyways, you might as well, you know, help out some other people while you do it, right?
That's exactly right. And we're changing our website, so look forward to big changes, more products. We're growing. So, I appreciate you guys for supporting us and for letting me come on and talk a little bit about my little baby here.
Oh, no, anytime. It's an open invitation for you. You know that. So, all right. Thank you, Dr. Porter, Just Cause Scrubs, and you know, hope to do it again sometime.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Anytime you give me a call.
All right, thank you. Take care. Have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye.
And that'll do it for this week. Thank you very much to Dr. Porter for giving us some of his time to discuss this very worthwhile passion of his. Again, the website for his company is justcausescrubs.com. Please go visit. If you're going to buy some scrubs, you might as well do it from this site and give some of the profit to charity. You can pick the charity of your choice from their list. And, you know, I hope you guys tell your friends and spread the word, because I think this is a very worthwhile cause. So as for us, you know, the website, orthotalkpod.com, you can catch all of our old episodes there. Give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcasting platform if you think we deserve it. And if you don't, shoot us an email and let us know why. theorthopodcast@gmail.com, or you can get to our Twitter handle, orthotalkpod.com, and send us there. If you want to catch the video of any of our episodes, you can do so at our YouTube channel, The Orthotalk Podcast on YouTube. That is it for this week. Hope you guys will join us next week. Hope you guys are enjoying what we're doing. Thank you for listening for the 30 episodes that we have done. We've got more in store for the future. Again, visit justcausescrubs.com, and thank you guys for the opportunity.